Everybody, this is Josie Student Nurse coming at you with pulmonary embolism today. So some of the things that we'll be going over for pulmonary embolism would be some things you might want to look for, such as clinical manifestations, some typical labs and diagnostics, and of course the pathophysiology of that. It's good to get a good understanding of how embolisms form, and we will also be going over the etiology and some nursing interventions along with pulmonary embolism as well. So let's get started. So the patho for a pulmonary embolism, first you have to start with an embolus. So those are formed through blood with vasoactive substances. And this gets stuck in the lung, and that creates a inflammatory response. This then gets to build up into the vessels and causes some pulmonary hypertension. And what you have left is good ventilation. So with ventilation, you're able to breathe in and out, but you have poor perfusion because of the embolus that's blocking in the vessel. And then you're left with hypoxemia. So you are hypoxic because your O2 sats have dropped below 80, and you're not perfusing because you have an embolus that's stuck in a vessel. So this also creates poor blood flow back to the heart and through the lungs, and without good blood flow, you're left with deoxygenated tissues, which results in infarction, and that's dead tissue either in the lung or the heart. And we don't want that. So there are three things that you need for pulmonary embolism. And basically these are huge risk factors that can cause a pulmonary embolism, which is 1, venous stasis risk. So when you have venous stasis, you're either very sedentary, you're bedridden, you have stasis going on, things aren't moving, you're also not moving, you know, after surgery, you know, with ORIFs, hip and knee replacements, any kind of surgery really that permits you to stay in bed and have a sedentary lifestyle. The second one would be a hypercoagulable state. So with this, when you're hypercoagulable, your blood is sticky and it's thick and it's more viscous than it should be. And when this happens, you either have the factor 5 genetics, you can smoke, and this actually promotes your platelets to become sticky, and you're postmenopausal, and lastly, we have vascular wall damage. So anytime you're cutting through or damaging the vascular wall, this is not good for blood flow, and it most likely happens through surgery or cutting through a large vein or any very major vessels like the femoral or the vena cava. All right. Next, we have some manifestations we can look for pulmonary embolism. So typically with this, we usually see people with a sudden sharp chest pain. We also see this sharp chest pain is worse with inspiration. So when you're breathing in, you get sudden sharp pains in your chest. These people also are tachypneic. They're dyspneic, so they're working to take a full deep breath, and they're breathing shorter and faster so they can get oxygen. They also are tachycardic. so their heart may be beating faster to kind of compensate to get some blood flow through the body and try to get some oxygen from the lungs by beating faster. All right, so whenever we see these signs, most things with respiratory, they all kind of have the telltale sign of being dyspneic or tachypneic or have chest pain. But what you want to look for with all of these respiratory issues and respiratory illnesses is the things that are different. So with pulmonary embolism, we usually see sudden sharp pain either bilaterally or on one side. All right. And whenever we see these signs, we want to know how we can better diagnose what we think is going on with the patient. So what we want to do is get ABGs, which is arterial blood gases. It lets us know how much oxygen is being perfused in our blood. And we want a D dimer. So a D dimer is a degradation product of an embolus. So when we see an embolus being formed or we go through any surgery, we have a lysis to prevent clots. And when we do have a clot, this D dimer product will be elevated. Or if we see extra blood from like a surgery or anything like that, we want to get a D dimer so that we can see if there's any fibrin lysis, you know, breakdown of a clot, essentially. So if we have a PE, this may be elevated. We also want to get a chest X-ray. This will show positive for pleural effusion, which basically means that air is not perfusing through the lungs. So we'll have an effusion, and basically that means air is being stuck and it's not perfusing well. It's going to be a little cloudy. We want a VQ. So a VQ means ventilation and perfusion. So the ventilation and perfusion is a scan that uses dye in your lungs, and they use dye and airflow to measure the blood flow through the lungs, and this measures in diagnosis a perfusion deficit. And if there's a perfusion deficit, it'll be off by like 1 to 0 or 1 to 2 or 0 to 2, because we want the ventilation and perfusion to be equal. We want that to be 1 to 1. But when there's no perfusion going on, this is what we call a mismatch. So when it's a mismatch, there's a perfusion deficit. We're getting ventilation but no perfusion because there's an embolus blockage. The next thing we want to order is a pulmonary arteriogram. We really want to remember the pulmonary arteriogram for pulmonary embolism because this is a gold standard. It's what diagnoses a PE. So what we do for pulmonary arteriogram is they use an iodine contrast through either one of the major veins. So that means through the vena cava, the subclavian, or the femoral, and they insert the iodine contrast in there. And then we get to see the dye moving through the arteries to the pulmonary arteries in the lung, basically. And this is the best method because we get to see with the iodine the perfusion through the lungs and if there's a blockage with the embolism. And that is what diagnoses a PE. Remember that. All right. So what do we want to do for this patient? how do we help them? How do we ease their chest pain, make them more comfortable? What do we want to do for them? So there is conservative ways we can help them, and there's invasive ways we can help them based on what kind and, you know, how big this embolism is. So we want to do a really thorough respiratory and cardiac assessment. This is where we want our focus assessment to be for this patient. Hey everybody, this is Josie, student nurse, with Just the Tips. So today we are going to be going over another respiratory illness, which is ARDS, which is an acute respiratory distress syndrome. So with this, we will be going over, you know, what it is, the etiology, who's at risk for ARDS, the pathophysiology, of course, because without a good understanding, we're never really going to know how to treat it. We are going to also go over the clinical presentation. What kind of sign and symptoms do we usually see with ARDS? Any kind of lab values or diagnostic that seem pertinent to this illness? And how do we help them? All right. So, with ARDS, this is a version of respiratory failure that is usually secondary to another event, which is characterized by the inability to provide adequate oxygenation and carbon dioxide excretion. So, we have poor ventilation and poor perfusion. And with ARDS, where do we usually see poor ventilation and poor perfusion? Where does this happen for us in the lungs? This usually happens in the alveoli. Alveoli is where we get all of our oxygenation in the lungs. It's a capillary barrier that gives the body oxygen and also takes away carbon dioxide so that we can exhale that. All right, so one of the common causes of ARDS is sepsis. Another one would be bronchial aspiration of gastric contents. So if we aspirate any kind of gastric contents that irritate our lungs, we have multiple traumas, usually of a long bone, a head of a long bone, or trauma to the lung that causes infiltrate. Or we have undergone any massive transfusion, or if we have a low perfusion. And where do we get low perfusion with a secondary event? Usually with a shock or sepsis. All right, and how does ARDS usually happen for us because of the secondary event? Usually our inflammatory response is set off due to any one of these injuries, meaning trauma, shock, sepsis, or we've aspirated something. This causes the permeability of our capillary membrane to kind of not be permeable anymore. Our alveoli are no longer able to stay open because of surfactant in our alveoli is impaired. And surfactant is what keeps our alveoli open. And when that is impaired, we can't have any gas exchange. And when this starts to happen, we have edema fluid and starts to form and precipitate in the hyaline membrane of our alveoli. Our surfactant production is impaired. So our alveoli is not able to stay open and they collapse. And this causes collagen deposits to form in the membrane and, you know, halts the perfusion and ventilation. And this actually causes scarring when collagen deposits form in the hyaline membrane, and we have fibrosis going on, which is basically scarring, and this causes our lung to be stiff, and this doesn't allow for adequate oxygenation to the tissues. So, what do we usually see patients with when they're going through in ARDS? They are definitely in a major form of respiratory distress, either through grunting, nasal flaring. They are very cyanotic because their tissues are not being oxygenated. You know, they have blue or, you know, pale skin, or they've got some pallor going on. They're breathing with sternal retractions. They are tachypneic because they're trying to compensate for more air, and they are trying to breathe faster in that way. They also have adventitious lung sound, so you probably don't even need to be here, like, to hear them breathe with a stethoscope. You'll probably hear them breathe adventitiously. All right. Now, what we think our patient is in acute respiratory distress. And how do we diagnose this? We usually want to get an ABG on them. First, they are in respiratory alkalosis because they're tachypneic. They're compensating to get more air. And when they compensate to get more air, they're breathing faster, and they are blowing off too much CO2. So they're going to be in respiratory alkalosis, and their CO2 levels are going to drop. And then you will see them in respiratory acidosis because they're not getting enough oxygen. Their CO2 levels are going to rise because CO2 is an acid, and they're going to build up in the tissues, and then you will see them in respiratory acidosis. So first, respiratory alkalosis, and then respiratory acidosis. We will also get a chest x-ray on them. We usually see a whiteout on that chest x-ray, which is, there's no darkness in the lungs, which means there's no perfusion going on. Another way that this usually is said is bilateral pulmonary infiltrates. So we have infiltrates going on in our lungs because our alveoli is not perfusing or oxygenating well because of the secondary problem. All right, so we usually see this patient also with refractory hypoxemia. So we see them with decreased O2 less than 50 to 60 millimeters per mercury with supplemental O2. So they're still going to be hypoxic even with supplemental O2. We also see their pulmonary capillary wedge pressure less than 18. So this usually means it's not a cardiac problem when it's less than 18. When it's more than 30, it's definitely an underlying cardiac problem. But with infiltrates, the PCWP is less than 18. And we want to see that because we don't want a cardio problem. All right. Now, what do we want to do for this patient? How do we correct their ARDS? What are some of the nursing intervention that is usually seen for this patient? We want to correct the underlying cause. What's causing their ARDS? Are they septic? Do they need antibiotics? Do they have bronchial aspiration? Did they go through a car accident and they've got trauma to the bone and that caused infiltrates in their lungs? So we want to treat that problem, whatever it may be. We want a supportive lung function. So this means that a patient with ARDS is going to be on mechanical ventilation. They are going to be sedated and on a paralysis, and they will be on 100% O2. They will be flipped and turned to a prone position so that the lower bases of the lungs can become oxygenated. They will be on PEEP. PEEP is to keep the alveoli open during the expiration, and this is no higher than 20. They will be on a vasodilator. They will be taking inhaled nitric oxide, which is also a vasodilator, for pulmonary, and this also prevents pulmonary hypertension and increases the lungs and the bronchioles in the lungs, so we can get more oxygen going through there and we can prevent further hypoxia. We always want to keep the alveoli open for better oxygenation, and this is why PEEP and is in mechanical ventilation on 100% FiO2 is so beneficial for this patient. We want permissive hypercapnia, and permissive hypercapnia means that we're going to make it okay that this patient has an increased level of CO2. They are still getting oxygen, but their CO2 levels is okay. Their high CO2 levels is okay, and they're permitting this because if we give them too much oxygen, this will cause barotrauma, volume trauma to the patient. We can't, too much oxygen is actually toxic for the patient. So we're going to permit, you know, the high CO2 to minimize barotrauma, a low tidal volume, and a low peak pressure. We will also give them bicarb to get that CO2 down. This will treat the acidosis if we put them on a bicarb drip while on mechanical vents. So we're permissing the high CO2 by giving bicarb and minimizing barotrauma, which is increased pressure in the lungs with oxygen mechanical ventilation. All right, this patient will also be taking inhaled nitric acid. This is a vasodilator. It prevents pulmonary hypertension, vasodilates pulmonary arteries so we can get better oxygenation. We want to prevent infection for this patient because they may already be septic and we don't want to give them a super infection with this. We're going to, you know, prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia, you know, closed suctioning, no circuit changes over 24 hours. Oral care is very beneficial to this patient as well. And we will not be giving them any prophylactic antibiotics. This prevents multi-drug resistant organisms if you give them a broad spectrum antibiotic. They will also be on nutritional support because, you know, obviously they can't feed themselves while they're sedated or they're paralyzed under a mechanical vent. So we want to give them a high-fat, high-protein diet with high calories. And with this high-protein diet, it maintains a positive nitrogen balance, which is essential for healing. And this is done through parenteral or enteral nutrition, TPN, and prevents depletion of plasma protein and promotes healing. All right, so this is ARDS in a nutshell. I hope you got something out of it. Thanks for listening.